to Day on Against the Grain. The Palestinian-American scholar Edward Said wrote critically important things about Israel, Palestine, and the prospects for peace and coexistence. I'm C.S. Jonathan Grobart considers many of Said's insights, and also the contributions of Ella Shohat, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Reconciliation and a peaceful and just coexistence. How are those things possible in Israel-Palestine? What would need to happen and who would need to get involved in order to create peace instead of enmity, reconciliation instead of conflict, coexistence instead of oppression? Today, we recall insights and perspectives advanced by the seminal thinker, writer, and activist Edward Said. Jonathan Grobart has devoted a section of his latest book to Said's thoughts and convictions, and also to important revelations made by the NYU-based scholar Ella Shohat. The book is Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism, Lessons from Hannah Arendt and Other Pariahs. Jonathan Grobart is professor of political science at San Diego State University. He's on the Academic Advisory Council of Jewish Voice for Peace. I spoke last year with Jonathan about a chapter in his book about Hannah Arendt. I invited him back to discuss a separate section, this one focusing on Edward Said and Ella Shohat. When Jonathan and I connected recently, I asked why he included Said and Shohat in this volume.
Well, this book is primarily motivated for looking for an alternative, more just Jewish perspective towards self-determination. But given that a central part of a more just Jewish view of self-determination in the land of historic Palestine means a just coexistence with the Palestinian Arabs, it became clear to me as I was researching my project that I needed to be able to engage the Palestinian perspective. And particularly, I was looking for a counterpart toward thinking about a outward-oriented, just Palestinian view of nationalism, and how that would be part of an interactive engagement with a more just Jewish self-determination. And eventually it did dawn on me that I was missing one important element. Even though I now had kind of a Palestinian counterpart to what I call the humanist Zionism, I was missing the, what eventually has been called the Arab-Jewish perspective, in that given that a big chunk of Israel's Jewish population comes from the Middle East, North Africa, so sometimes referred to as Mizrahim Jews or the Arab Jews. And so long before there was a state of Israel, or long before the Balfour Declaration of 1917, Arab Jews had a long history of practically interacting with Arab societies, Arab cultures. So I realized I was missing a central dimension to thinking about Arab-Jewish coexistence. So that's how both Edward Said and Ella Shohat come in. Edward Said is the preeminent critical Palestinian perspective that thought long and hard about coexistence of Jews and Arabs in the same land. And then Ella Shohat is really the pioneer of critical Mizrahi or Arab-Jewish thinking on how the various peoples came to interact. So the Ashkenazi Jews, meaning the European-derived Jews, the Mizrahim, and the Palestinian Arabs.
Let's jump right into Edward Said. And Your discussion in this book about Said focuses partly on his book, The Question of Palestine, which became a seminal text in Palestine studies. The Question of Palestine was published in 1978. What did Edward Said set out to do with this book?
Primarily, Edward Said was seeking to make the Palestinians protagonists to the West, in particular to the U.S. audience. So if you think of this time period, it's right after the much celebrated Camp David Accords between Israel and Egypt, mediated by the United States, where it seemed as if there was now peace in the Middle East between Israel and the most powerful of the Arab states, Egypt. But within all that, the Palestinians went away. And so what Edward Said was doing is, it should not be that easy to erase the Palestinians from thinking about the Middle East. And in particular, there's an urgent priority in the West and the United States in particular to get readers, to get the broader audience to learn about the Palestinian experience. So his primary purpose was to make the Palestinians the protagonists. The secondary purpose, which is also quite important, was to think of a vision of coexistence between Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs. But of course, it had to start with actually recognizing that there are Palestinian Arabs.
You note that the book, The Question of Palestine, was among the first in the West to identify Zionism as a settler colonial ideology, by which Said meant what?
Settler colonial means a people from the outside, particularly from Europe, coming into what's called the developing world, the world that's been under imperialist control. So in this case, the Middle East, particularly after World War I, is now under French and British control. So Palestine is under British control. And so settler colonial means settlers from outside, so from the non-colonial world, so from Europe, coming in with the intention of not simply exploiting the indigenous, that would be more standard colonialism or imperialism, but actually displacing the indigenous and taking it over themselves. So it's a Zionism, a settler colonialism. It's a later version of what the United States did in the late 18th century. Or you could think of examples of Australia or Canada displacing the indigenous. In Palestine, they're displacing the indigenous Palestinian Arabs.
Jonathan Grobart is my guest. He teaches political science at San Diego State University. We are talking about his latest book, Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism. Edward Said characterized the Nakba, the 1948 Nakba, during which there was a mass violent displacement and dispossession of Palestinians during the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. He characterized the Nakba not as an ad hoc reaction of the Israeli government to that war, but rather as what?
Rather as being essential to the Zionist project. The Zionist project, based on settler colonialism, meant that the Jewish presence had to be the overwhelming majority. So the settler colonialism of Zionism meant taking over the bulk of the land and being an overwhelming majority of the population. So up to the 1948 war, the Jewish community was still only a third of the population, and they still had only roughly 10% of the land that's now historic Palestine. So when I say historic Palestine, I mean the Israel boundaries of the 1967 border and also the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And so the Nakba was inevitable because the only way that the prevailing Zionist project could succeed is to capture the bulk of the land and to be an overwhelming majority of the population. So in this case, the only way Zionism could prevail is through a Nakba. And, you know, it's not only Edward Said that argued that. He was just an early exponent of that view. Later, the Israeli revisionist historian Benny Morris, who's written about 1948, also said, he said it approvingly, that, yeah, of course the Zionists had to displace the bulk of the Palestinians. He said they should have displaced all of them, not just the bulk of them, to have made it. But that was central to the Zionist project. And so Said is one of the first to make it very explicit.
So you said that one of Edward Said's main projects with his book, The Question of Palestine, again published in 1978, was to have people recognize the Palestinian people as a protagonist, and even as a global protagonist. What did Said see in the aftermath of the 1967 war? And this was a terrible time for the Palestinians and the Arab world. Israel seized the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip, as well as the Golan Heights and the Sinai Peninsula. But what did Said see in the aftermath of that Six-Day War that he found encouraging for the Palestinians and the Palestinian cause?
Yeah, it is interesting that so much of the book, Question of Palestine, kind of gets us after 1967, when he's talking about the Palestinian rebirth. It's not that he's disparaging Palestinian life between 1948 and 1967, but there is a certain historical irony. And this great Israeli victory and second catastrophe for Arabs of the 1967 war, which actually does include the expulsion of 200,000 plus more Palestinians from the West Bank, Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem. But it does spur on the emergence of an independent Palestinian movement. So between 48 and 1967, Palestinian politics were submerged under Pan-Arabism. After the mid-1950s, it submerged primarily under Nasser, Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt. So the one bright spot for the Palestinians is with the overwhelming defeat of Egypt, you know, along with Syria and Jordan in the 1967 war, there could be sort of no excuse for putting off an independent Palestinian movement. So this is a remarkable thing in this book that comes out in the late 1970s, as you're seeing what was really exciting about the PLO. The PLO becomes independent after the 1967 war. And it's possible because it emerges after the destructive impact of the 1967 war on the Arab leadership in general. So it is an exciting time, and much of what Said writes about of what the Palestinians have accomplished is focused on the decade following the 1967 war.
And as you know, Said approved of the consensus-based approach, the democratic approach of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. And you write that underlying this approach was a new vision of national liberation, which Edward Said called the Palestinian idea. What did he mean by that?
The Palestinian idea was, first and foremost, for Edward Said, this ecumenical pluralist society. So it was a society, according to Edward Said, that was not nationalist in the narrow sense. So it was not, say, limited to Palestinian Sunni Arabs, right? That would be the overwhelming majority of Palestinians were Sunni Arabs. That the Palestinian idea was a secular, pluralist, democratic vision. And so it represented a type of liberation from colonialism that did not reduce itself to just recreating the narrow nationalism that had taken off with decolonization after World War II. So the Palestinian idea to him was this new idea of liberation that wasn't bound by a narrow nationalist view, and that did insist on attention, consciousness of preventing another exile group. So the Palestinian idea meant to be very sensitive of not recreating exile and oppression of a subgroup. So that to him is what's very exciting about the Palestinian idea, and where he sees the Palestinians as an avant-garde, particularly within the Middle East, of this new vision. So it's not just a simple matter of self-determination of a people, it's a new model.
So if a certain kind of cosmopolitanism was integral to the Palestinian idea, as Edward Said understood it, then what did he think of the extent to which Palestinians understood, or I should say needed to understand, the Israeli Jewish experience, historical experience, and its impact on Zionism?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important question. I think it was not well appreciated originally in the West when the question of Palestine came out. So much was just focused on bringing up the Palestinians. But Said himself, right, is this cosmopolitan person. You know, in a later interview, he talks about how, you know, I'm like the old cosmopolitan Jews, being of multiple worlds. If the old cosmopolitan Jews knew European society, but also knew the distinct Jewish society, he, as a well-educated American Palestinian, originally from Palestine, well understood the West, but he also well understood the European-derived Jewish world. So when he talks about the need for Palestinians to look at Israeli Jews, and more broadly than that, looking at European-derived Jews in general, as a people with a rich, diverse history. So they're not just the oppressor. So of course, one has to think about what Israelis did to Palestinians. And so much of the question of Palestine is the subjugation that the Zionists, particularly the primarily European Jewish community, did to the Palestinians. But if one's going to move on and continue this idea of this new type of society, then he does urge Palestinians to look more deeply at the Jewish experience, and particularly what Zionism meant to the Jews. And only then is it possible to have a just future.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Jonathan Grobart is my guest, Graubart. He's professor of political science at San Diego State University. He's on the Academic Advisory Council for both Jewish Voice for Peace and Open Hillel. And we are talking about his latest book. It's called Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism, Lessons from Hannah Arendt and Other Pariahs. And a while back, we had Jonathan on to talk about a chapter of this book that focuses on Hannah Arendt, and I invited him back to talk about another section of his book on the two towering figures of Edward Said, and hopefully we'll get to talk about her, Ella Shohat. So you write in your book about Said's involvement with and support of the PLO in the 1980s, but at some point he became disillusioned with Arafat. He resigned from the Palestine National Council, the PNC, in 1991. And then Said was an observer as the Oslo Accord, the first one, was reached in 1993. And you write that Said's spirited and far-reaching criticisms of Oslo launched his second phase as the preeminent Palestinian intellectual opponent of not only U.S.-backed Israeli rule, but also Palestinian elites and the new peace orthodoxy. Unpack that for us.
Yeah, I think this is the most fascinating chapter in Edward Said's history. And, you know, it's sad in a way to read about his disillusionment with the PLO. It remains, you know, all the more relevant now, but he's identifying this already in the early 1990s. So he's bitterly disappointed by Arafat and his top leadership agreeing to the Oslo Accords, because the Oslo Accords, as he very perceptively pointed out, turned out to be a deal that's enabled Arafat and kind of the small cadre of Palestinian leadership to retain their domination over the Palestinians, but at the cost of gutting the idea of Palestinian liberation and being just subservient to Israel and kind of ultimately the U.S. dominated global order. So his writing now develops a greater sophistication on the Palestinian idea, because now he realizes that I no longer have the PLO as an umbrella group that's mostly positive. Now the elite, the leadership of the Palestinians, is actually a problem in itself. Said is facing this problem that this exciting new vision of Palestinian liberation that could be a model for other societies is now being impeded by the leadership that is courting dominant powers that's kind of given up the idea of broader liberation. So he's now struggling to articulate and find allies for this alternative Palestinian vision that's trying to develop this emancipatory vision that will include just coexistence with Israeli Jews, and that will take on both the primary oppressors, meaning Israel and the United States, which underwrites Israel, but also the Palestinian leadership, which is also impeding independent, emancipatory Palestinian vision. So this is where he comes up with the need to develop this movement from below, this Palestinian vision that will challenge both the Palestinian hierarchy and Israel and the United States.
So looking for political activity, organizing, enlightenment from below, as opposed to on the level of the Palestinian leadership like the PLO, Edward Said looked to, I think, certain communities or sub-communities that he thought might be uniquely positioned to foster a sort of bottom-up approach, a bottom-up energy in favor of peace and just coexistence. What sorts of groups was he looking toward? Which sorts of constituencies did he find were doing encouraging work?
Here's how Said describes what he's looking for. Is he's looking for independent-minded, ultimately Israeli Jews, Palestinian Arabs, and you know, all others interested in solidarity, whose essence, to quote him, was coexistence and sharing in ways that require an innovative, daring, and theoretical willingness to get beyond the arid stalemate of assertion, exclusivism, and rejection. So he's looking for those who are willing to move beyond just the nationalism game, you know, so we want our own self-determination, so this zero-sum game, to think about how do we bring ourselves together, and how do we connect the exciting things about self-determination toward a more just world in general? So for him, the constituencies that are most promising would be Palestinian citizens of Israel, who, while they do have citizenship status in Israel, are certainly second-class citizens. Their advantage is they know Israeli society, they know Israeli Jewish society well, and they are invested in making Israel more democratic, more ecumenical, so more pluralist. And the other group he finds particular appeal in, and this may be a good transition or, you know, some, a connection to Shochat, is the Mizrahim, so the Arab Jews, who have generations of interacting within Arab society, have also at times, you know, been second-class citizens in Arab states, but are committed toward some type of pluralist vision that doesn't do away with either distinct Jewish identities or distinct Arab identities, but has this synthesis. So that's what he's hoping for. Those that think beyond just the box of narrow nationalism that Zionism certainly was a victim of, but more and more, particularly by the 1990s, as he saw Palestinian nationalism just became this very narrow vision. Fortunately, there are elements that are challenging that. In particular, there's some constituencies that can be especially useful.
And how did Said propose that Palestinians not living in Israel could join forces with, as you said, Palestinian citizens of Israel and Mizrahi Jewish people living in Israel? Again, the Mizrahi being the Arab Jews, the Jews with Arab heritage whose ancestors came from the Middle East and North Africa. Did Said have a proposal for a way in which these, say, three constituencies could get together and unite and work together toward what he wanted, which was, again, peaceful coexistence, just coexistence?
Yes. For Said, beyond just the Palestinian citizens of Israel and kind of critical Mizrahim in Israel, is he actually saw the other big hope that I neglected to mention in the last answer, of Palestinians and Jews in the diaspora that by definition, you know, had more of a cosmopolitan identity. So they weren't, because they weren't in, say, either occupied Palestine or in Israel, that they already, you know, in just in their daily lives, had to interact with multiple communities. So he saw the both the Palestinian diaspora and the Jewish diaspora, including in the United States, but not exclusively in the United States, as they could play a crucial role in bringing about a type of dialogue, including dealing with the collective traumas of the Holocaust and the Nakba, and then what Palestinian national identity and what Jewish national identity, meaning Zionism, what that meant as a promise to Jews and Palestinians. So within the diaspora, where you link this more cosmopolitan awareness while still invested in either the Israeli Jewish community or the Palestinian Arab community, that they could play a crucial role in helping out those forces who are living, say, within historic Palestine that are trying to do this. The advantage of those in the diaspora is they're not hemmed in by a nationalist chauvinist leadership, either in Israel or in occupied Palestine. And so they could point the way.
That's the voice of Jonathan Grobart. He teaches political science at San Diego State University. And we are talking about his book, Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism, Lessons from Hannah Arendt and Other Pariahs. It's published by Temple University Press. You'll find links to Jonathan's faculty page at San Diego State University, as well as to the book, Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism, on our website, againstofthegrain.org. My name is C.S. Song. So for a time, for many years, Edward Said backed a two-state solution. And in this book, you go over his rationales for doing so. But by the mid to late 1990s, Said no longer believed in a two-state resolution to what was happening there. And I want to ask why not, and what he advocated in lieu of a two-state arrangement.
In Question of Palestine in the late 1970s, he does come out for two states, so it's not something he's prioritizing. In that book, too, he's prioritizing a just coexistence between Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs. He concludes that two states makes the most sense, say, in the late 1970s, because it's consistent with how international law and UN Security Council and General Assembly resolutions are seeing how to deal with the problem, and some kind of formal, symbolic recognition of Palestinian self-determination through an independent state is important for the Palestinian development. But he cautions even then that his two states does not mean a divorce between the mostly Jewish state of Israel and the mostly Arab state of Palestine, but it should be an invitation for moving toward open borders, toward collaboration, that the two peoples will still be very connected across historic Palestine. Even with the Oslo Accord, when he criticizes the Oslo Accord in 1993, it's certainly not because of two state. In fact, Oslo did not actually bring out the idea of two state. Oslo left it open-ended and brushed aside the international consensus of what two state would look like. So his initial criticism of Oslo in part was that it actually undermined the international consensus of two-state and made it a situation where Israel essentially called all the shots. It got to keep settlements. It got to keep the occupation. It got to take the lead in deciding when the Palestinians had sufficiently showed that they could coexist with Israel on terms that Israel favored, and left open-ended whether this would mean a Palestinian state. So eventually, by the mid to late 1990s, as the Oslo process is leading to an expansion of the settlement population, it's leading to bypass roads, to more checkpoints, and toward a life where just Palestinian daily living is worse, he concludes that what passes as two states is not something that's giving dignity to Palestinians anymore. It's this warped thing where it's some kind of hemmed in Palestinian statelet, right? Not a real state, but a statelet that's constantly subjected to Israeli interventions, to an Israeli presence. That there's no longer anything appealing about the two-state vision. And so that's where he's looking for a new vision that gets back to the ideals he was promoting all along in Question of Palestine, of needing a new type of coexistence where it's moving beyond zero-sum game of national self-determination. So it's not just a He never called for just some kind of liberal, democratic, single state where national identity didn't matter at all. He was calling for a type of binational coexistence all along. And so by the late 1990s, he says the two states, as formally conceived, no longer holds any appeal. We now have to think more creatively, more broadly about how we can coexist. We know that both Palestinians and Jews are attached to essentially all the land. We know that our fates are interconnected. We know we have distinct identities. So let's figure out a more creative way. And so the binational vision.
Some listeners may find the notion of a binational single state puzzling because the tendency is to think in terms of nation states. So how can a single state be binational? Said saw a binational state, and I'm reading now from your book, as honoring the enduring national attachments of Jews and Palestinians to the same land. Did Said lay out specifics on what concretely such a state would look like, how it would be administered?
So he's doing brainstorming for the last 4 or 5 years of his life. He dies in 2003. He doesn't articulate a full blueprint of what this would look like. One has to look elsewhere for that. He just says that at the end, one cannot have rigid borders between a state of Israel and a state of Palestine. But one also has to recognize that they do have distinct identities. So there's kind of, they have to figure out new political, social, and economic models to coexist. He is looking, so he's conscious of these past programs that were formulated, you know, before 1948. So that's one framework to look at. But his point is, we actually just need Israeli Jews, Palestinian Arabs, and also the diaspora of Palestinians and Jews to get together. Ultimately, they're going to have to work something out, but it's going to have to be something that's very different than just, you know, a separate state of Palestine and a separate Jewish state of Israel. And so it's come up with the will and the vision, and then you can come up with how do you actually develop the specific institutions. So he's more like big picture and not formulating the specific federalist model. Other people have now followed up on what Said's doing, but he's kind of the big picture person.
Jonathan Grobart teaches political science at San Diego State University. We are talking about his book, Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism. I'm C.S. Song, and the program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Jonathan, you noted earlier that Edward Said identified certain communities or sub-communities positioned, uniquely positioned to foster a binational pluralist spirit of coexistence. So one of those groups was the Mizrahi Jewish, the Arab Jewish critics of Zionism within Israel. Ella Shohat is a Mizrahi. She teaches cultural studies, by the way, at NYU. And she is another focus of your book. And she wrote about the Zionist denial of the Jewish Mizrahim, which is interesting because a lot of people think about Israeli Jews as a monolith, and she certainly does not, and much of her project was about talking about how the Mizrahim were different than the Ashkenazim, the European-derived Jews in Israel. What did she say about what Zionism has done to the Mizrahim in Israel? What the Zionist project, how the Zionist project targeted the Arab Jews?
So Shohat is in part inspired by Edward Said's writings on Orientalism and his book, Question of Palestine. So her breakout essay, the second part of the title, is Zionism from the Standpoint of Its Jewish Victims, whereas Said's first essay that later becomes part of Question of Palestine is Zionism from the standpoint of its victims. So she's building off Edward Said's ideas on Orientalism and how Zionism had this ideology that enabled and justified the subjugation and the displacement of Palestinians. So she brings just an added scope, an added dimension to Zionist Orientalism. Is it not only meant diminishing and subjugation of the Palestinians, it also had to deal with Jews that weren't from Europe. And so the chunk of the Jewish community that were from the Middle East and North Africa, so the Mizrahim, or eventually the term is used, the Arab Jews. And so there she's saying, this too will help us learn about what were the problems of Orientalism and a narrow chauvinist nationalism, you know, what Arendt called tribal nationalism, that says that we as a people cannot coexist with another people, that we're just kind of bound to be in conflict. So the Mizrahim present a puzzle, particularly if they're Arab Jews. They speak Arabic, you know, their cultural traditions are closer toward Arab non-Jews than they are to European-derived Jews. Yet, obviously, their religion is Jewish, and they have distinct Jewish practices. And so they don't fit into this narrow chauvinist nationalism, but to the prevailing Zionist viewpoints, their Arabness is all seen as inferior, something that has to be pulled out. So their role in all this is to be subordinate Jews in the state of Israel that will have a lower position, and for their development they'll need to shake themselves of their generations of Arab heritage. So one learns a lot about just how crippling Zionism was to internal tensions among Israeli Jews. So that's the negative part. The affirmative part, so what Weissy's also writing, is this is an inspiring story too. Is it turns out that we do have centuries of Jews and Arabs and other communities coexisting in this region of the Middle East, North Africa. And so if we want to kind of think about how to move forward, let's look at the most appealing times when these people coexisted. You know, it wasn't sort of a perfect coexistence, but it was daily getting to know each other. It was shaping each other's identities. And if we're looking for a future that's more pluralist, that has a just coexistence, the Mizrahim can tell us a lot. So she's giving plenty of reasons why it was wrong for the dominant Zionist histories to give such limited attention to the Mizrahim. You know, the dominant Jewish history just said, well, yeah, we had to save those poor Jews in the Arab countries from being persecuted, so it was great that we brought them over to Israel. She says the story is actually far more complicated, far less flattering for the Zionist experience, but on the other hand, it also gives a source for thinking about how to move forward. And so it's the Mizrahim that actually serve as a inspiration on how to develop a more complex Israeli-Jewish identity, and one that's more open toward coexistence with not only Palestinian Arabs, but the Arabs in the region.
There's a lot more about Shohat that you've written about in this book, as well as Edward Said, but I do want to ask before we wrap up, what you would think Edward Said, who died in 2003, what you think he might say today at a time of, you know, intense hostility and bloody war in Israel and the occupied territories, what he would say given, you know, his stress on reconciliation, his stress on a just coexistence, his emphasis on Palestinians needing to understand the Israeli-Jewish experience more, of course, his stern condemnation of Zionist oppression of the Palestinians. What he would say at times like this, I imagine he wouldn't abandon many of the premises and ambitions and hopes that he had, but how do you think he might react to someone saying, you know, given the current conditions, how could one even start to think about reconciliation, about Palestinians working together with some Israelis inside Israel, with how can one begin to think of people coming together and coming up with a just solution?
I've been thinking about that issue a lot lately, obviously post October 7th. I think Said would, in one sense, just be very depressed about the grim state of affairs, but also take hope that there is still this impulse, this sentiment. One sees it more in the diaspora of Jews, Palestinians, other Arabs, and just all others committed to justice in the region, you know, participating in these protests, calling for a ceasefire, and calling for an alternative program. So ultimately, he would sadly have to say he was right. If we just reduce it to this narrow nationalism, we're going to just fuel the worst elements of Israeli Jewish society and Palestinian Arab society. And there, sadly, he's right, is that, you know, Israel now has its most extremist government ever. And if you look at public opinion surveys, just the general view of Israeli Jews is pretty intolerant. But then if you look at formal Palestinian governance, whether it's the West Bank or Gaza, they're kind of stuck between, on the one hand, there's what remains of the PLO, right? So the Fatah party that controls the Palestinian Authority, that's authoritarian, that's repressive, that's subordinate to Israel, and that's manifestly ineffective. And then there's Hamas, which certainly has a very narrow nationalist vision that's also brutal. So neither of them present any kind of exciting political vision. So if we have these depressing trends both ways, the need for a very different vision. And again, I think it's still, there are elements within Israel of both critical Mizrahim and Palestinian citizens of Israel. And then I'd say all the more so in the diaspora, including, say, in the United States, where there's a good deal more productive collaboration among Jewish peace and dissenting groups, Palestinian groups, other Arab groups, and social justice, anti-imperialist groups in general. So it's that element. And plus, I think, you know, it comes down to one's either just in despair that, you know, the Israelis are going to win and it's just going to be ugly and ugly, or the fact that it remains binational. It remains roughly the same amount. You know, in historic Palestine, it's roughly equivalent of Jews and Palestinians. And so it's binational. Right now, it's a very unequal binational where the Jews overwhelmingly dominate. but the binational remains persistent. And so the same challenge remains of how do you come up with a different type of vision? And so it's despair now, but I think one just has to look at what are the most appealing elements within Palestinian society and Jewish society, both there in historic Palestine and in the diaspora. So I don't think anything would ultimately change in his analysis. I think he would remind us not to sort of get excited about either the Palestinian Authority or Hamas. He wouldn't need to remind us about not to get excited about the Israeli government, but he might need to remind us not to sort of look at any excitements about Hamas or even its October 7th actions. He would ask us to kind of step back and think about how can we develop a vision that gets us past the state of affairs we're in now with Israel-Palestine.
Jonathan Grobart, again, G-R-A-U-B-A-R-T, political science professor at San Diego State University, the author of Legalizing Transnational Activism, The Struggle to Gain Social Change from NAFTA's Citizen Petitions. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism, Lessons from Hannah Arendt and Other Pariahs. Now, Jonathan, thanks for your work and for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, C.S. Thank you for having me on.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.